Welcome back to The Mystical Positivist. I'm your host, Stuart Goodnick, joined in the following interview with co-host Dr. Robert Schmidt, director of Tayu Meditation Center and founder with myself and Jim Wilson of Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol, California. This week we present an interview pre-recorded on Skype with Mariana Kaplan. Mariana Kaplan, PhD and MFT, is a licensed psychotherapist, professor of yogic and transpersonal psychologies, and the author of 7 books in the fields of psychology and spirituality, including The Guru Question, The Perils and Awards of Choosing a Spiritual Teacher, Eyes Wide Open, Cultivating Discernment on the Spiritual Path, and the seminal Halfway Up the Mountain, The Error of Premature Claims to Enlightenment. She has spent 20 years researching cutting-edge and controversial topics in Western spirituality and dialoguing with the great spiritual teachers, scholars, and luminaries of our time. She is a leading spiritual psychologist using somatic approaches to psychotherapy to support spiritual practitioners and teachers with the process of healing trauma and moving toward psycho-spiritual integration, and working with the complex discernments that arise in the context of spiritual practice and in spiritual communities.
Yeah, beautifully said, Rob. And you know what? What just to add to that is that by staying in the relationship with him, I think with my master, when there was profound disagreement, brought us to the other side. Right? It was actually both, all of that happened, but nobody left each other. He didn't leave me and I didn't leave him. I moved away, I made my own decisions, but I didn't cast him out of my heart ever. He didn't cast me out of my heart, his heart. So I didn't know that model. I didn't know that model, and because we were a small spiritual school, and the people who got really upset and needed to do their own thing left, and the people who stayed, you know, often listened even when they were going against their own, what we call it, their own deep need. And I tried out this model with him. There's a little story, I think you might enjoy this. The first time I left the ashram, because I had a great push-pull to the actual crucible of living in spiritual community. I lived in ashram life for 6 years, but I was always quite impatient and wanting to be out in the world and experiencing its people and its places. And the first time I moved away from the ashram, I was 30, and I was off on my first solo adventure in 6 years, and I found myself in Varanasi, and I had been meeting up with Israelis. When you're a young traveler, Israelis are everywhere. So I had all these Israeli companions along the way, and they're really challenging and intense. And I would tell them my story, and they'd say, "Well, you know," somehow they'd say, "Like if you're," they were challenging me to like cast the guru out of me and find the inner guru, something like that.
The evil spirit.
Relinquish the guru. And so I don't remember exactly what they told me, but I found myself on the banks of the Ganges very early in one morning, like all prepared to do this big ritual of casting the guru out of me. And I found my little corner and had my candle and went inside and prepared to like cast. I think it was like, if he's real, he'll come back. My principle, you know, you let it free, and if it's real, it comes back. So I was going to cast him out. So I went inside and I used all my energy and I threw him out of me. And it didn't work. So I thought, oh, I must have done something wrong, because usually if I use that much power and intensity, right, I can kind of, I thought at the time I could kind of mobilize what I wanted to. So I went back inside again for another pass. I went inside and I threw him out of me. And it didn't work. And suddenly I don't know why, but I realized then I was like, oh, that's because he's already mixed with me. Like he's inside of me, and he, like me and him were already blended and inseparable. And I realized that, you know, no more than you could take out like a couple of inches of your heart and leave the rest, or right, like take off a part of a particular vein, like inside of your body, like that it, that he was just, we were already blended, and it wasn't possible what I was trying to do. And it was a great joy. It was a great joy. I never needed to do that again. So even when I felt great dissent, you know, and rebellion, and never wanted to leave. Just wanted to, you know, I just wanted to have the freedom to follow my own, you know, deepest longing, even if they weren't perfectly accurate, you know, or mixed with unconscious. I still, somehow as a person, I needed the freedom to do that. And there's been some very interesting practitioners I've met along the way, or not met, some people I've really admired. Leonard Cohen is one of them, and the others I probably shouldn't name, but, you know, kind of well-known, respected teachers or authors, and they've had a similar story where they spent, whether it was 20 or 40 or 50 years in the master's company, and simply had a need at some point in their life to know the experience of what it would be like to live from their own inner authority. They just had this pull. And one woman I can think of, she was with her teacher and, you know, a great Swami in the tradition for 40 years, and it was all working, but she wanted to have the experience in her life of living from her inner authority. And of course, many people like you all, our teachers died, so we ended up having, I would have had that experience anyway, but I didn't know that. And I think that's, you know, that's just the need that some people have too. And we're living with a lot of, like, right, we have to be really wide to put all these things in the same space.
Yeah.
I'm devoted to my teacher. I live independently. I have a guru. I live by my own inner authority, you know, like they don't, that's why I love the body centered work. They don't fit in the mind, those contradictions, but they do fit in the body.
It's when I hear you speak that way, one of the phrases that you've coined in some of your writing of conscious discipleship comes to mind, that there's something active about being engaged with a teacher, being a disciple of a teacher, that is still a role of complete responsibility, where one can be surrender, in a sense, one's will to the teacher, or act independently, but in either case, you're completely responsible. And it's being opposed to a reactive place or a place of fear.
Yeah. And parental projections, right? That's where it all, so many people end up leaving the teacher because the web of projections are just, it's just too thick to get through.
Yeah, and that's an interesting one, you know, in the sense that I can see where, you know, we were talking about the confrontative role in the past, where that methodology falls apart when there are like projections in play, that there isn't a sort of a mutual responsibility, or to use Rob's language, a mutual listening.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that both on the side of students, and I also see it on the side of teachers, where there's particularly in confrontative traditions, there's a tendency to have a shotgun approach, where you see this in the fourth way a lot, where, you know, everyone wants to act like Gurdjieff, you know, to be the quickest to point out unconsciousness or something like that, but it's not arising from an organic place of listening to the being need of the other person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, the vantage point that I find myself bringing to my work right now is that I work with spiritual fallout. I work with it every single week.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, why did I get that job? I just ended up with that job that isn't the job that most people have, you know, with multiple traditions
No, you're pretty uniquely placed, I think.
Yeah. Well, also, you're uniquely placed in having that job when you haven't, what's the right word, when you haven't been a casualty. I mean, it's like you're not, you don't have an axe to grind. You're not engaged in this work to prove that spiritual teachers are all frauds or anything like that. It's quite the opposite.
Yeah, I'm a true believer. I believe in spirituality. I believe in the path. I believe in gurus. I believe in discipline. You know, I'm very, very much the opposite. And yet, I hear so ever since I wrote Halfway Up the Mountain, I was 28, 29 when it got published, I've been receiving these stories. So when we wind up this question of the force and that method, I think I've just heard too many stories of the pain that's come from that. Not to not think that it's effective, mm-hmm. but I think I just have a really tender place in my heart for the thousands and thousands of people who that hasn't worked for.
Right.
Because most people, as you describe your upbringing, Stuart, right, most people on the path didn't have that good fortune. So most people, and as we were talking about John, who's one of my old friends and was mentor for many years, this idea that we have to have this psychological integration before we can withstand that kind of work, that the problem with that is that kind of psychological integration is a lifelong process for most people. So you can't do that for 5 years and then have it done. It's like a bit of a chicken and the egg thing. Because, right, if the bits of shock that we got, right, if it undermined something enough and made space to work with the wounds, right, this is where psychology and spirituality start weaving, and then some piece of the deep vulnerability gets integrated and you have more strength to endure shock. I see it more like that because it's a lifelong process for most people.
It's certainly the case that my own observation of my own experience in the spiritual path and what I've seen with students is that there's progressive levels of intensity that people are able to receive. And in a way, it's a principle in our own practice that the student really needs to request or make clear or put them in the position that they want that kind of intenser engagement. That it's not the case that, you know, we go around looking for people to be intense with. it's more the case that someone really has to earn that by demonstrating their own integrity with respect to that process.
Yeah. Yeah. And we could also say that because both of those processes are kind of lifelong integrations, you can also go the other way. Like I went for the shock, you know, the shock method first, and then more integration later. I mean, they both want to happen. So, right, life just doesn't usually end up that linear. So people, you can get kind of, you know, big spiritual experiences and principles and the benefits of rigorous teachings, and then do some of the more tender, what we're calling psychological work, later, or intermittently, concurrently. There's Rob said, there's just no one way that it works for anybody.
That's right, and I was gonna underscore that the point about concurrently, because it was actually my experience. I didn't really get what spiritual bypass was about, because my own experience was so intimately wove together, you know, my relationship with my teacher, so intimately wove together these different strands that I didn't really fully get this idea until we had our radio conversation with John Wellwood, and I really got where he was describing so many people are coming from about this distinction, and it was a great service for me, because with all my experience of seeing people in other traditions all the time, I still didn't in my bones grasp this heartache that people had for very good reasons. Because of the particularities of my own experience, so that's one of the reasons why I keep coming to deepen my appreciation for just how differently people are constructed, just how differently their propensities and needs have to be addressed, and so. So I'd like to, you know, we've been talking for quite a while in a number of different arenas, but I'd like to get specific about some of your work that you've been doing. I mean, you've written some fascinating and wonderful books. You already mentioned Halfway of the Mountain. There's Do You Need a Guru? And then The Guru Question. There's Eyes Wide Open. And we could talk about a number of different aspects of those books, but I guess what I want to make some space for right now is to talk about your yoga and psyche project, because it segues from what I was just saying, because for a long time I wasn't quite grasping why you were going in this direction. I think I have a better grasp of it now, but perhaps you can articulate how this integration of somatic bodywork practices that both come from traditional paths like yoga and some other more recent innovations, is something that you've integrated with psychological work.
Yeah, happy to talk about it. I'm a little bit curious. It kind of makes me smile when you say you didn't know why I was going there. As a therapist, I want to know a little bit more about that.
Well, we can talk about that, but go ahead and tell us first.
Okay. You know, when Lee had me write all those early books, and he would give me the title, and I would freak out, and then I'd go about and write a book about something, and then integrate it later. That was sort of the process for many years. And so I was writing all these different books. I mean, my whole series of spiritual books was really The Error of Premature Claims to Enlightenment, Challenge of the Student-Teacher Relationship in Western Culture, Discernment. It was like, it was about all the, it was like about everything that could go wrong. And people have been really appreciative of that over the years. And when I first wrote Halfway Up the Mountain, I was like, wow, I wonder how long it'll be before I can just write about what's like good and whole and right, you know, kind of like not... I understand that uncovering, very well I understand that uncovering what is untrue leads to truth. I mean, that guided my life. But when I was very young, I wondered about that. And then I saw myself writing, you know, the books that, you know, after a time I came up with my own book ideas, but that was the line that I was going in, and I just accepted it at a certain point. I thought, okay, maybe that's just my job and my function in life. And it occurred to me recently that I'm actually finally, you know, working on a piece that is like, it's not deconstructionist. It's actually constructing. I'm sitting in my garden as we're talking, and I think it's just a different phase of my life. And how I got here is related to the conversation that we've had, but I'll back up a little bit and see if I can trace it. My introduction to yoga was really Yogi Ram Sarathkumar, which was Lee's teacher. We haven't talked about him very much, but right, he was one of the saints of old, the kind of master of masters that I think rarely exist, rarely found anymore. And he was a great, great transcendental, trans-religious, trans, you know, he was just unique. He was a saint. So in, you know, in a very deep way, that was the introduction to yoga. And I met Lee and Yogaram Sukumar at the same time. Well, I met Yogaram Sukumar the day before I met Lee in India, 94. But as I went on in my years with Lee, there was a great deal of attention placed on what we called kaya sadhana, or the sadhana of the body. And yet we were all, many of us were practicing so hard and serving so hard and pushing our bodies so hard and, you know, pushing beyond, sleep. We pushed ourselves so hard that in my case, I got sick. Mm-hmm. I always exercised my whole life, but there was this piece about embodiment that I resonated to in our tradition, but we didn't really have the methods for. We had lots of methods for lots of other things, but not really treating the interior of the body. Mm-hmm. I think certain practitioners in our tradition had found a way in, but not globally. So fast forward, life goes on, and in my early mid 30s, two things happened. One, I got sick, and the other was that I found that there were patterns inside of me, and that took the form of repetition on the externality of my life. That weren't going away, that I really wanted to go away. Now, in my tradition, it would have said, you know, if it's needed for service or it's needed for the work, it'll be taken care of. If it's not needed, you know, it doesn't need to be transformed. Mm-hmm. And again, here's one of these differences. Like, I understood that principle, at least of our work, but I also had always been touched by people like Arnaud and saying, and people also want to be happy. So there were things in myself that I still needed a response to, that I just wasn't fully the way that I was working and the practices that I had weren't getting to. Mm-hmm. So I was a therapist before I met my teacher. I've always loved psychology. So somewhere in there I called up a friend of mine because all of this trauma research was just coming online, just starting to get known, these new trauma methods. And there was a colleague at school, teaching at the university, and I said, can we meet for lunch? And I asked him about his what he had been learning about trauma in the body, and I was very compelled by what he said, so called him the next day and asked if I could come in and be his client for a while. And I went in, and he started working with me. It's hard to really remember what happened in that session. All I knew is that he kept interrupting me and asking me what I felt in my body. And I was annoyed by it because it felt very rude. He just kept interrupting me and I was trying to pour out my heart and soul and psyche, and he kept interrupting and asking what I was feeling in my body. And I left the session and the next day woke up and said to myself, that was the best therapy session I've ever had. And I actually started referring people to him over and above myself, because I just thought that he knew something that I didn't know and that it was really valuable and really effective. I worked with him for a while and a number of his colleagues. So I ended up enrolling myself in Peter Levine's somatic experiencing 3-year training. And at the same time, or a similar time, I found yoga because I was struggling with this illness. And my personal experience was that with all that spiritual training, it was actually the physical yoga, mm-hmm. as introduced not by a hot yoga class, but by a teacher who understood sutras and practice and context. Mm-hmm. That the physical yoga and then this really, state of the art method for getting in accessing trauma, it's really scientifically studied and backed and neuroscientifically informed method. They, those processes took me inside of consciousness in my body in a way that nothing else had. And through the yoga, I healed my illness after, you know, working with 3 years of every kind of doctor under the sun, every conventional and alternative doctor and supplements and machines. And the yoga, you know, the yoga healed my body, and the somatic work taught me how to access the contracted places in my psyche as they live in my body. And I just fell in love. I fell in love with that. So I think how I got to what I'm doing, and as I mentioned, John, I interviewed John Wellwood for one of my books when I was in my 20s, and then I used to come visit him, and he became a mentor, and then he became a very close friend. And what I connected to in his teachings and has never left me is, for me, the intersection of depth psychotherapy and spiritual work are utterly, utterly inseparable. It's like a marriage that I would never leave. It just makes sense to my soul. So I've known that for a long time, that's what I understand to be true. And I introduced John and Lee many years ago, and they became great friends, and Lee respected John's work very much, and vice versa. So as it, you know, as life goes on, like I followed the yoga for ever since, and my loves are this transformational work that, like my friend Christina Sell, she was another long-term student of Lee's, but a yogi. For her, her yogic lineage is like Yogi Ramchandra Kumar and Lee, even though they didn't teach Hatha Yoga. Mm-hmm. Like that's how she understood, and then all of her yoga teachers on top of that. So for me, my inner life, my spiritual life, I don't really, it's Lee and all the yoga that I love. And my, you know, my other, the other great piece of knowledge that healed my body, that helps me work with clients in a way I never ever could have before, in a way that I don't think talk therapy usually gets anywhere near, is to work in the body from the inside out rather than from the outside in. So I think I taught my first yoga and psyche workshop at California Institute of Integral Studies in 2007, just as I was getting into all this yoga training and all this somatic training. And I guess the answer to your question, Stuart, is that I've come to it because that's the field in which I'm working out my own human integration and integrating all the skills that I'm learning in life that can be useful to other people.
Awesome.
Got it. You are listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Gudnick. Co-host Robert Schmidt and I are speaking this week with our guest by Skype, Mariana Kaplan. Mariana Kaplan, PhD and MFT, is a licensed psychotherapist, professor of yogic and transpersonal psychologies, and the author of 7 books in the fields of psychology and spirituality, including The Guru Question, The Perils and Rewards of Choosing a Spiritual Teacher, Eyes Wide Open, Cultivating Discernment on the Spiritual Path, which won 5 national awards for Best Spiritual Book of 2010, and the seminal Halfway Up the Mountain, The Error of Premature Claims to Enlightenment. I guess one thing that I'm interested in on the somatic therapy is, I'm relating it to, in the fourth way practices of sensing or practices of putting attention on the body and the importance of making that extra connection and going from the inside out, as you put it. And in fact, in traditional fourth way, the practice of self-observation really begins with sensing, putting attention on the body, because that's where we can most easily be objective and not get lost in stories about things, but actually be present to the experience, direct experience, as it's happening. And so I'm interested that you find that as a key in your own work now. And it seems like from t- tying it back to the earlier conversation, it seems like that's a really powerful way into finding and healing and opening the traumas that people experience at very early ages. So I'm kind of interested to how you connect those things together.
Yeah, just clarify for me for a minute. Connect which one?
Connect the earlier conversation about the sort of the soft approach, the teasing mm-hmm. out, or sort of with loving attention, allowing someone to become present to early trauma, and how that relates to the somatic work.
And I'll make a little note here that when I was trained in all of the somatic work, spirituality was never mentioned. It's not a spiritual approach. It's an awareness approach that helps you kind of get inside the sensations of the body. So it may be more along the lines of self-observation, but without all the context of observation of the body. But because I had been with Lee and the tantric tradition for so many years before I engaged all of that, I was given, quote unquote, that teaching, and I was mind blown. I was like, wow, this is how tantric transformation happens from the inside of the body. So for me, I guess it landed on a principle that was pretty ripened in me. Mm-hmm. And it was, if you can imagine, in the creative part of our conversation, it was like an alchemical explosion. It wasn't like, oh, I learned, trauma methods. I was like, wow, everything that, Lee had been teaching us, sadhana of the body, and it can happen by learning how to place our consciousness in the interior of our cellular makeup and unravel the stories and the deep psyche. And, it was really one of the big things that's happened in my adult life. It's revelatory for me. So as we weave that back to the conversation, I'm not really seeing it as like that's how people unlock their traumas so that they'll be available to spiritual transformation. It's like one completely one and the same. It's just so like the tantric process of transformation that was taught by Lee, and even if spirituality is never mentioned, when I sit with a client and we enter their body and their awareness with love, it's a process of turning toward and becoming one with, as Arno used to talk about, like everything that's inside of us, to become one with all the different emotions and sensations and traumas and images and stories and memories. And it's more like that.
So that's why you could have the experience this morning of getting the answer that Lee would be pleased with what you're doing now, because you're experiencing it as this fulfillment and expansion of his work and your work with him. Is that fair?
I hope so. I mean, as you guys mentioned, I could be wrong. You might not be proud of me. I might have just been imagining it. Maybe I finally found through all this work enough self-love and self-acceptance to know that he would love me anyway. that's why he'd be proud of me. Because he's just proud of me. And I don't hate myself anymore through all this work. So, it really could just as easily be that. But
well it could like, be both. It could be both too.
Yeah. But I think through all this work it is. It's my, I think that the good parent always wants the child to take Judaism again. My mom gave me this quote, it's a parent's job to give their child roots and wings. So I think the good parent, and in some way he's the spiritual father, a spiritual friend. They want to give their child and disciple roots and wings. So I feel congruent right, with what I do. I just keep growing it. So it may be more like that. And also because the processes that I've worked with the body and trauma, have really convinced me that, I imagine John must have talked about this because I know he's been working with self-love really powerfully for several years now, is that this, you know, what sounded like a new agey principle many years ago of self-love is this profoundly true and important possibility. So I think in my somatic, in yogic process to date, I've understood how to bring love inside, at least to, you know, many or the places that I'm conscious of. So I'm just adding a layer of complexity to your kind reflection that's why Lee would be proud of me. I'm not sure.
You don't have to be sure. That's okay. In fact, I even said that it would be better if you weren't sure, but that being what it is,
it feels really congruent.
Yeah,
it feels like I'm bringing together everything I've learned my whole life and available to, you know, to further learning.
Right. So how could people not applaud that? But I want to deepen, get a little better grasp of how you've married these non-yogic somatic awareness therapies, body awareness therapies, with yogic practice. I'm curious about that, and I'll just preface that briefly by saying, you know, what you were saying earlier about body awareness, even though the fourth way has body awareness practices, I myself have found a new level of that just in the last year by hooking up completely unexpectedly with a Kriya Yoga teacher in our up here in Sebastopol. So I have an appreciation for some of what can arise from that now in my personal experience in a way that I didn't before. But I want to get a sense of, if you can explain for our listeners, how you're marrying these somatic practices with the yogic practices, as I understand it, within the context of fulfilling psychological or addressing psychological issues.
Yeah. Okay, $1 million question. What can I do with that question in 10 minutes? I can start.
Yes.
But I think I'll have to really let it be a start, because I would feel so disloyal to what I'm passionate about if I was going to try to summarize everything in this last little bit of our time together.
Sure.
So something like the yoga tradition is more or less 5,000 years old. It's really old. And from my understanding, it's at least one of like the oldest living traditions that has actually sustained itself through a really long period of time.
Yes.
Right, it's twice as old as Buddhism, and there's going to be someone of every tradition that roots something older, but it's one of the traditions that has lasted through thousands of years.
Yes.
So, and has lasted, you know, with this cultural migration and its own forms. There's big conversations about that, but there's something about it, right, that people of every age and every nationality, every culture, many, many, many people benefit from it when they're exposed to it. In every continent, right? Rich, poor, trauma, you know, victims of hurricanes, it's used in wars, right? It's used among the rich and the poor and 90-year-olds and babies, like mommy baby yoga, I mean, right. At least toddlers. There's something like I get from that. That there is a knowledge base that's right. It's a great force in the world. It just couldn't touch so many people if it wasn't. And part of yoga's brilliance is that it has this, it's right. Well, maybe some people listening don't know, but you know, the postures in this bigger philosophical yoga that could be divided into eight limbs. It's one, it's the third limb. So yoga is a vast, vast field that includes discipline and right livelihood and breath and meditation and consciousness, right? And postures are placed in the middle of that somewhere. But all of those things have given knowledge of how to awaken consciousness in the body. And it's why even when people go to some sweaty, hot yoga class and they don't have a spiritual bone in their body, they often get something from it besides exercise, right? It's yoga has a transmission in it. So let's start from there. And then if we come over here to the Western world, psychology is just over 100 years old. I think it's about 125 years old. Some radical people who I tend to feel very aligned with suggest that Western psychology is like the Western world's contribution to spiritual traditions. It's almost like a spiritual tradition arising in the West. Now, people will get mad at me for that one, I know. But wow, Jung, I mean, someone like Carl Jung, you don't get a greater mystic than that. You know, psychology is just beginning. So the fact that it hasn't caught up to some of the older traditions, it's a Western, you know, it's a Western approach to working with the afflictions of the Western psyche. And it's very young. I mean, if psychology keeps going, imagine where it'll be in 500 years, 1,000 years, it'll be 2,000 years. It'll be surely, in my mind, as brilliant as Buddhism, and or another tradition just in its own way. It's new. It's a baby. And in this baby tradition, we have things available to us that weren't available before, like science. That, again, it's something that a lot of hardcore spiritual practitioners, including myself, would have dissed. But we have neuroscience, we have brain science, we have so many ways of measuring and working with things like trauma. There's just some Western psychology has approaches for penetrating the contents of our consciousness, right? Whereas a lot of these traditions, they access the whole process of consciousness. But Western psychology has helped us learn how to work with the stuff, the actual, you know, the actual stories, the contractions and the like. So for me, encountering this really, really intelligent, scientific, neuroscientifically based methods for accessing trauma in the body. And let me say that the core of this method, that somatic experiencing that I studied in, it was about the soft overcomes the hard. It taught us how to penetrate and enter these, what you said, Robert, I guess, called that black box. Mm-hmm. How to enter it, like 1%, I enter when I work with people 1% at a time for 30 seconds to a minute. So we'll get near these things. Mm-hmm. But instead of like when I was a young woman, you go in there and you feel it fully and you get into the feelings and you exercise them and all that crazy stuff. This method, it's really, really like, it's like brain surgery, heart surgery. Like you go in, it's a whole method. So I don't want to do it injustice to articulate it here, but it kind of prepares the psyche and then touches into these places in a very small percentage of them, for a very, very short period of time. And then backs us out, and it also teaches us how to cultivate, wholeness and pleasure and, spaciousness in the body. So it's this dance of a polarity where you go into the body and it's the contents of its consciousness, and you move between building and learning how to touch and experience pleasure and wholeness. And from that highly resourced place, you touch into and digest little bits of the contraction and the trauma at a time with love. So I'm blending the two, and in this dance between the two, the body starts to change. The body starts to change, and people discover a way to what it does is it gives this tool that can be practiced on the road. I mean, I practice it when I have one arm and I'm running out the door. It's because it can be practiced in 1 minute increments once it's integrated. And it's like you start to learn when these contractions come up and these painful emotions and that, right, the things that happen to everybody every day, just getting to work or wherever, you know, just the stoplight and the stress. And you learn how to meet the contractions in your body with this kind of love and spaciousness, and almost digest them as they're coming up, not to make them go away forever, but like a way where you can learn how to digest the contractedness in your body on the run. So it's like a little sketch, but that's where I go with it. It's like a very empowering process that is, it's got a method, it's teachable, and people who aren't interested in spirituality and people who don't want to spend 5 years, you know, in depth psychology, it's something that people can learn and practice with. And because so many of our teachers are present in this conversation, I kind of bring back Arnaud here. And Arnaud de Jourdain, right, this great one French spiritual master that all of us knew and loved so much, their whole teaching was really about saying yes to life. And they have these wonderful nuanced teachings in their tradition. Like, if you can't say yes to what's coming up, you say yes to the no. Mm-hmm. If you can't say yes to the no, you say yes to the no to the no. And for me, with this process, you actually can do that in the body. Hmm. And things come up all the time, and it's this really, when it's integrated, it's this way that whatever's coming up in our being, we can say yes to, or we can't say yes to it, but we can say yes to the contraction on top of the contraction, or to the no on top of that. And like yoga, right, it's this gradual, progressive unwinding of layers of conditioning and stories and self-chatter and self-negation and self-hatred and truth. Well, how did I do in 10 minutes?
That was awesome.
That was perfect.
And your timing was exceptional. You know, we have to end shortly, but I have really, really enjoyed this conversation. I really enjoyed the fact that in this last 10-minute segment description of what you're doing with combining yoga and psyche, you use the word pleasure a number of times. That's a word that is used too infrequently in, quote, spiritual, unquote, conversations. So I hope we can do this again. This was a lot of fun.
It was.
You know, speaking of pleasure, when I was, you know, the other wonderful thing about my work as a psychologist, as it is because I work with all spiritual practitioners, I can just quote Arnaud and Lee and Robert and Yogi Ramchur Kumar as I'm working with clients, so I don't have to hide anything.
Right.
And so I was telling a client a story the other day who was suffering some spiritual affliction, how when I was with Lee all the years, every year we'd go to visit Arnaud, of course, and Lee would teach at Arnaud's ashram. And we were so austere, right? We lived in this really, you know, this austere desert ashram, and I lived in a, you know, a trailer, as my brother said, the size of my parents' kitchen table, and one bathroom for 14 women and the kids, and then we'd go visit our nose, where you all have been, and it's a converted villa, and actually a whole valley that came with it, you know, and our nose students would you know, drink wine, and they were involved in the arts, and many of them lived in Paris and had sophisticated jobs, and I we'd go on these visits, and I, you know, I always had a kind of jealousy
well, duh.
Of their lifestyle, because it had so much pleasure and style, you know. And you know, they, when you just mentioned pleasure, it's like they get to do all this rigorous, uncompromised practice, like in a villa, in the countryside, with nice French wine, and like couldn't I do that? And they were, right, Arnaud was ruthless and uncompromised and a great, great master. So I want to second that, but I know that austerity has its value, but if I had the choice, as I sit in my garden here in Fairfax, I really, I'd love to transform in an uncompromised way, with a little, you know, a dose of nice wine and blue skies.
Hear, hear.
Yes.
Well, thank you again, Mariana, for joining us in the Mystical Positivist. This has been just fantastic, and I do want to do it again.
Indeed.
Yeah. And I just want to say before we close that I just have so much love and respect for both of you and the lifelong efforts and integration and teaching. I have, from a deep place in my heart, I have just profound respect for both of you and the work that keeps unfolding. So I'm so grateful to be able to spend this time with you.
Well, thank you so much. The feeling is mutual, and we will look forward to that next conversation.
Very much so.
Until then.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Co-host Rob Schmidt and I have been speaking this week with our guest by Skype, Mariana Kaplan. Mariana Kaplan, PhD and MFT, is a licensed psychotherapist, professor of yogic and transpersonal psychologies, and the author of 7 books in the fields of psychology and spirituality, including The Guru Question, The Perils and Rewards of Choosing a Spiritual Teacher, Eyes Wide Open, Cultivating Discernment on the Spiritual Path, and the seminal Halfway Up the Mountain, The Error of Premature Claims to Enlightenment. Next week, The Mystical Positivist will feature a rebroadcast of our April 2013 conversation with Lodro Rinzler, a practitioner and teacher in the Shambhala Buddhist lineage. He began meditating as a child and sat retreats as a teenager, even going so far as attending a silent month-long retreat during which he shaved his head and took monastic robes and vows. When he left for college, he received 2 heirlooms from his parents. From his father, a mala which he had used to recite mantras. From his mother, her father's flask. He utilized both greatly in the 4 years ahead. During that time, Lodro became a Vajrayana student of Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche. He also established Buddha House, an 18-person dorm at Wesleyan College, which hosts a large meditation room. He began teaching meditation at that time. After leaving college, he was recruited to the position of executive director of Boston's Shambhala Center. He began leading numerous workshops at meditation centers and college campuses throughout the United States. Lodro served as the head of development for Shambhala internationally before founding his own nonprofit, an authentic leadership training and job placement organization. His column, What Would Sid Do?, appears regularly on the Huffington Post and the Interdependence Project, and his writing has appeared in Shape Magazine, Real Simple Magazine, The Shambhala Sun, Buddha Dharma, and The Good Men Project. He is the author of 2 books, The Buddha Walks Into a Bar and Walk Like a Buddha. Lodro writes from his apartment in New York City, which he shares with his dog Tilly and his cat Justin Bieber. Tune in for that show on Saturday, October 5th, 2013. Upcoming on the spiritual calendar in Sonoma County, the Renewal of Presence Practice Group with the Tayu Meditation Center staff will be meeting Tuesday at 7:30 p.m., October 1st. That's at Mini Rivers Books and Tea, 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. And then, as part of the Thursdays at Mini Rivers series, Power, Politics, and Spirit, Going Beyond Dichotomies, with Gus Dzeraga, Ph.D., author of Pagans and Christians and other titles. That's Thursday at 7:30 on October 3rd, again at Mini Rivers Books and Tea. It's no great insight that American society is in trouble, our political system is working poorly, and virtually every issue is presented in simple-minded dichotomies built around liberalism versus conservatism. The truth is quite different, more interesting, scarier, and also more optimistic. Traditional liberalism and conservatism have both broken down, and what can invigorate both and provide an ethical ballast to American society is a revival of spiritual traditions with an immanentist rather than transcendental or world-denying bias. Gus Dzeraga is a noted pagan author who also holds a Ph.D. in political science from UC Berkeley, has taught internationally, authored many academic publications, and organized international conferences. His fourth book, Fault Lines, The 60s, The Culture Wars, and The Return of the Divine Feminine, will be out in November. Thank you for joining us once again for The Mystical Positivist. Podcasts of all our shows can be found at www.mysticalpositivist.blogspot.com, as well as commentary and discussion of topics of interest to the show. Also, please send comments and feedback to mysticalpositivist@gmail.com. Join us again next Saturday. Coming up next from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. is Ken Watts on Rockin' Record Hop. Stay tuned.